The idea of non-corporeal beings in Theravada Buddhism. Okay. And it is a kind of a realm of kind of Buddhist cosmology. You know, it's not something that the Buddha made up and taught about. What it is that at the time of the Buddha, you know, within Brahmanism, okay, and within the most of the major traditions, it was simply taken for granted that there were people in bodies like us, and that there were other beings who weren't in bodies, but were still hanging around in the same environment as well. Some of them beneficent, some of them sort of neutral, and some of them with attitude. And that it was just part of existence. And their behaviors, you know, various things were ascribed to them. If somebody got sick or got hurt or the crops failed or something, such events might be ascribed to the behaviors of these non-corporeal beings. So we were discussing that here a little bit, and one of the things that really struck me when I was on retreat in July at Spirit Rock is that some of the teachers there are actually spending a fair amount of time talking about the devas. And these are Western teachers, you know, for the most part, who have, you know, we pretty much hang out together in sort of science-based consensus reality, or what Lily Tomlin calls our collective hunch, you know, as to how things are in the world. And yet, these teachers, especially the ones who had spent years and years as monks or nuns or monastics, renunciates in Asia, were really pretty deeply rooted in either Thai culture or Burmese culture, really, you know, would say, you know, it's really kind of important that you keep an open mind about this stuff. So, this is, you know, there's so many different attitudes that can be brought to bear, or ideas about this realm of teaching, that, you know, whether it's all just kind of wishful thinking and fairy tales, or somebody's brain gets too scrambled from doing deep samadhi and all of a sudden they start seeing stuff and hearing stuff. And then from my own experience, my own research and writing on the spirituality of indigenous peoples in North America and elsewhere, became quite evident to me, just as in Southeast Asia, that the lived reality, the understanding of how things are, you know, for a great number of cultures actually includes the existence of the spirit world, you know, non-corporeal beings. So what I would like to do to this evening is to hold for us together these two ways of understanding, you know, the idea of, or these teachings on, a cosmology in which there are these planes of existence called lokas that non-corporeal beings inhabit, which is part of Buddhist lore, you know, is talked about all the time in the discourses. Okay. And the different ways of understanding what's going on there, whether as a cosmological framework or context, or more metaphorically in terms of what's going on in one's consciousness at any one point in time. And as I said, a surprising number of teachers at this retreat and others that I've sat with actually have deva stories to tell, and so do I. And so I'm going to be sharing one of those a little bit later on in the evening. So in this whole realm of spiritual cosmology and the existence of non-corporeal beings, you know, Carl Jung is among those who did some of the deepest early modern exploration of religious iconography where he was looking, or what was sometimes called the technology of the sacred, where he would study, for instance, in the Catholic tradition, you know, the practice of reverence for or application to the goodwill of the saints, and these various people who have been beatified and are thought to be spirit beings who may be available to help one out. So what Jung was saying is that, and he got particularly interested in Eastern religions toward the end of his life. What he was positing was that, and this is very true in the Vajrayana tradition, which I practiced in for a while, that whether it's the saints in the Catholic tradition and some other Christian traditions, like Saint Barnabas, for instance, or the bodhisattvas and the deities that you find in the Vajrayana and the Mahayana tradition, that in fact what these can be thought of is manifestations of qualities of consciousness that are to be revered, that are to be cultivated in one's own consciousness. So for instance, in one of the Vajrayana practices that I was taught, there is a certain deity that would come to mind, or a certain bodhisattva. And so what one would do would be some chanting for the invocation of that deity or bodhisattva. One of the reasons, or one of the functions of artwork in the Vajrayana tradition, is to create images of these beings. It's why the Westerners that conquered the East, and you know, were accusing all the Buddhists of idolatry, because there are these images there, when in fact the Buddha's teaching is that of not self, you know, nothing's real, it's all appearance. But at any rate, the understanding that in envisioning one of these deities, one of these bodhisattvas, okay, meditating on the qualities that that entity embodies, that entity represents, okay, what it's doing is summoning forth that quality in one's own consciousness. And so in one of the visualization practices, what was done was you would envision the deity, okay, the invocation, you would meditate on the qualities of the deity, whether it happened to be like Tara, you know, bodhisattva of compassionate action, or one of the other bodhisattvas or deities. And imagine, you know, this deity in their full presence. And then what you do would be to draw them in to yourself and embody that deity and its qualities. So you would become that deity or that bodhisattva. Okay. And then in the final stages of this practice, you would project that being back out again from your own heart and then dissolve it. So that what you had done would be to bring forth, to summon, to meditate on, to focus on the qualities of consciousness of that being. You know, get a clear sense of what it is you're focusing on, draw it into your heart, and then project it back out onto the world. Understanding all the while that what you're doing is just that. You're manifesting this presence. So, I had thought for a long time that the Vajrayana was a lot like the Catholics, you know, because of the artwork and, you know, all this, you know, reference to, you know, these various spirit beings and whatnot, and that the Theravada was more like the Quakers, you know, it was really, really, you know, stripped down version, very simple, not much going on. But then I eventually came to have a somewhat different view, okay, as I explored more fully, more thoroughly, some of the Theravada Buddha teachings on realms of existence. So in the Greater Discourse on the Establishing of Mindfulness, the Buddha talks about the meditator in doing insight meditation, mindfulness meditation, understands the contracted mind, the mind imbued with anger or fear, to be the contracted mind. Understands the expanded mind to be the expanded mind. Understands the exalted mind to be the exalted mind. Okay. And what he's talking about here are realms of consciousness that expand beyond the boundaries of the constructed self, the discursive self. The planes or realms of existence, they're talking about, there's actually a total of 31 of them, and I couldn't rattle them all off if I wanted to. But basically, they fall into three main categories. One being arupa loka, which is very refined states of consciousness, ones that are associated with very deep practice of the Brahma Viharas, of the cultivation of compassion for self and others, of the cultivation of selfless joy, okay, of the cultivation of deep equanimity and peace of mind, the cultivation of generosity. So in the Theravada, you don't have deities that are associated with each of these qualities of mind necessarily, but you do have the same intention in terms of seeking to cultivate or develop them. So in the realms of existence, there's the arupa loka, the ones, these refined states of consciousness associated with basically living or residing in the Brahma Viharas, or residing in jhanic states, which is to say states of very deep samadhi that are suffused with ebullient physical energy, or their extreme joy, or very, very deep calm and peace of mind. Okay. And then in the fine material states, there are beings who are kind of in between these non-corporeal beings and the corporeal beings, okay, but still enjoying these very, heightened, refined states of consciousness of being. Okay. Then when you get down into kama loka, which is the states of being associated with sense desire, sense contact, then it starts to get a little more complicated and a little more dense and a little more rough. There are the human states, and we're kind of in between sort of, the pleasant ones and the unpleasant ones. A state in terms of planes of existence, below the human one, is the realm of what are called the asuras, sometimes referred to as sort of titans. These are great, huge beings, who are very powerful, but are also very violent and very angry. Okay. And live their lives in states of extreme aversion. There is the realm of what are called the hungry ghosts. And in Buddhist artwork, they are depicted as beings with great, huge stomachs and very small mouths. Okay. So they have appetites that can never be quenched. So they're constantly seeking out sense gratification that can never actually be requited. So they live in these states of sort of torturous, unrequited desire. And then there are the animal realm, and these are the realms where beings are incapable of full consciousness. They suffer, they experience life, but they don't understand why, they don't understand anything that's going on. And then below that are the hell realms, okay? And these are realms in which there are beings who, by virtue of their behavior, when they were inhabiting one of these other states, live in a state of perpetual torment. In the cosmological understanding of this, okay, the teaching was that beings would be born into a higher or lower realm dependent upon the karma that they generated in the realm they were living in. Okay. And so in the cycle of rebirths and existences and whatnot, then where you were going to spend time the next time around depended on how you behave this time around. You're kind of a cause and effect relationship. None of these, unlike the Christian ideas of heaven and hell, none of these is permanent. You do time in one or another of them, and then you get reborn to do time in another one, depending on how you behave in the last one. And so there's a lot of moving around that goes on. It's a cosmological understanding. Sort of the psychological understanding is that each of these realms of existence is a state of mind that we experience. So if you think about it, the deva realms are what's experienced when you are not just doing Brahmavihara practice, but actually feeling yourself to be within one of the Brahmaviharas. You're feeling deep compassion for yourself or others. You're feeling this sense of selfless joy that has no outer cause. You know, this lightness of heart, you know, of just being genuinely happy and wanting others to be as well. Of very deep peace, you know, really being in a very deep, calm realm of acceptance of things as they are. Of the heart being wide open, of loving all beings without boundaries. Okay. So it's possible, if that's happening, or if you happen to find yourself in one of the jhanic states, you know, that is basically analogous to inhabiting a deva realm. Okay. In the human realm, you might find yourself, you know, as most of us do when we're sitting, experiencing some calm, maybe some peace of mind, some positive regard for oneself or others, or you may be really wrought up about something, anxious or angry or afraid or you know, sad or depressed or whatever. You might be either just broken up with, you know, your relationship may have just ended and you're feeling a lot of longing, you know, or you just got canned or something and you're worried about where your next meal is going to come from, how you're going to pay the rent. So you feel this unrequited desire, this longing. So one of the things that you can notice is that when they talked about the Asura, you know, the hungry ghosts, the hungry ghosts are greed, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, the kalesas. So those realms of existence correspond to greed, hate, and delusion. Okay, the animal realm that is the deluded mind, one that just doesn't understand what's going on. Okay, the mind that's infused with greed, unrequited desire, okay, the hungry ghosts, the one that's always in a state of extreme aversion, okay, the titans, the asuras. Okay. When the mind becomes so imbued with these, you know, what the Buddha called the torments of the mind, greed, hate, and delusion, then you're living in a hell realm. As we can see, a lot of people seem to spend a lot of their lives living in a hell realm. Okay. If they have little or no power, then basically they suffer alone. If they have a lot of power and they're living in a hell realm, they may inflict a lot of suffering on others at the same time. And it is indeed possible to observe the behavior of others and get some idea of what realm they tend to be hanging out in. Okay. So this is more the kind of the psychological understanding of what's going on with these 31 planes of existence. The interesting aspect of this that Jung also pointed to was that not only might these things go on in terms of anyone's individual consciousness, but when you get together with others who share that same frame of reference, that the collective consciousness of those who are in that same state of consciousness can have tremendous power. Okay. So for instance, we can notice that, you know, I know a lot of people have told me, you know, it's certainly experienced it, whether it's coming, you know, in the our Sangha here, or especially if you go on a retreat Sangha, you've noticed a qualitative difference between what it feels like to sit at home alone and what it feels like to sit with a group. And one understanding of that, that Jung and others might have, is that when we sit together, we are basically experiencing a collective consciousness at a certain state. Okay, so if it is indeed our intention to cultivate states of calm and peace of mind and compassion for self and others, okay, that we share that aspiration when we sit, and that it creates this realm of being, this realm of consciousness, one that we co-create and that we co-experience. Jung used to talk about the collective unconscious, right? This might be thought of as the collective superconscious, you know, our ability to come together and reside, cultivate these states of mind that has the result of affecting us all. So, my Deva story. It's one that was pretty powerful and happened on this last retreat I was just on. And it originated when I was filling out my retreat registration form before going on the retreat. And there were questions in there, Spirit Rock being Spirit Rock, about things like sexual orientation and gender identity. And so I really had to contemplate those, because the Dharma is all about telling the truth. And I had to reflect on whether or not I was going to tell the truth. The truth is that for all of my life, I've been a straight, gender-fluid male. Which is to say that my gender identity is essentially about a 50-50 combination of male and female. I know some of you probably know this territory better than I do, but they're two related but really distinct concepts, you know, one being sexual orientation, the other being gender identity. Sexual orientation being who you're physically attracted to, okay? Gender identity being who you consider yourself to be. And there are two basically aspects to gender. One is biological gender. You know, what kind of equipment you're carrying around on your torso, you know, what you were born as physically. And there are markers for that, and genetic markers for that. Turns out there's increasing evidence that there are also genetic markers that occur not on the torso, but manifest in the brain with regard to gender identity. Whether you consider yourself to be principally male or female, or, as in my case, some mixture of the two. So those whose gender identity and biological gender align are said to be gender conforming. Those whose gender identity and biological gender are not aligned are referred to in medical circles as being gender dysphoric. Some who feel very, very strongly that their gender identity is completely at odds with their biological gender, basically go about chemically and surgically altering the body so it better conforms to their gender identity. Okay. So in the realm of transgender, that's one sort of realm of being. And these are both referred to as kind of linear dynamics, but I think not really. When I think about sexual orientation and gender identity, for me it's like an XY axis, and what it does is kind of map out a playground. And people move around, you know, do you want to play on the swings or do you want to play on the jungle gym? And, so that both sexual orientation and gender identity are a good deal more fluid and less binary than we usually like to think they are. I am toward sort of one end or in one corner of that, in that I have no desire whatsoever to do anything to my body except lose 20 pounds. maybe grow my hair a little longer, right? So, and, you know, I'm happily heterosexual. I've been married for over 40 years. My family are very supportive of my having come out. So when I was filling out my registration form, I put down, you know, sexual orientation, heterosexual, gender identity, transgender, / gender fluid. Basically a kind of a 50-50 mix. I was planning basically to live in the closet for the rest of my life. Okay. About 10 years ago, I went to a therapist that specialized in gender dysphoria and got a better sense of what was going on, the map I was just telling you about. She recommended to the extent possible to start, you know, manifesting the feminine presence, you know, because that's actually the healing path, you know, for those who can do it. And so I had done so to a limited extent. I was part of a straight gender fluid men's support group and whatnot, but I had pretty much decided to stay in the closet. Until my heart condition worsened. And I had a really significant bout of atrial fibrillation just before going on the retreat. And I was over shopping at REI, getting some stuff to take on the retreat. I happened to walk up through the women's clothing section, and there was a sale on plus-size women's yoga clothing. And so I was looking there, and I said, wow, you know, if I were out, I could buy some of those things and wear them on the retreat. As it is, I'm probably going to die without ever having fully lived. And then another thought arose and said, no, I'm not. So I bought some clothing and I took it on the retreat and I filled out my registration form and, you know, gender orientation transgendered / gender fluid. And I came out on the retreat. It's the first place that I'd done it, and in retrospect, I think it was an extremely wise choice. I came out in the group interviews that I went to, and I was dressed more or less like this a lot of the time when I was on retreat. I came out in the group interviews. Greg Scharf, who was one of the teachers who was the one that would lead the evening chants for us, you know, saying, may the devas protect you. And Kamala Masters, who is a Dharma teacher I've known for a long time, and is of Filipino ethnic lineage, she said, oh, how auspicious, what good karma. Because I had been kind of freaked about, you know, going ahead and coming out. And she said, you have the ability to experience both gender identities while also understanding that all identities are illusions. And quite so, you know, she was talking about, you know, the relative and the absolute. You know, that at the relative level, it can be really important to honestly and fully and openly live the truth of your existence, your Dharma. And at the same time, to realize that in Buddha Dharma teaching, you know, all identities are illusory. We assume them. We put them on like a set of clothes, you know, and we project a persona to accomplish certain objectives. But the trick is understanding that that's what we're doing. And I was also concerned about how my root teacher and my Dharma teaching mentor for the last 20 years, Joseph Goldstein, we feel about it. And when we sat for an interview, he just said, you seem very happy and very relaxed and very at ease, you know. And it was true. You know, I told him that on this retreat, unlike almost all the others I've sat in the last 40 years or so, I felt I wasn't practicing the Brahma Viharas. I felt I was inhabiting them, you know. I felt bathed in self-compassion and compassion for others. I felt kind of a gentle joy almost the whole time I was there, just this sense of release and of freedom. And I was also, went to a GLBT discussion group within the retreat sangha, and there was that same sort of kind of affirmation that happened, you know, it's just this sense of real freedom. In the evenings, And this happened, this particular event happened the evening of the day that I'd come out to one of the groups. We were in the evenings after the evening sitting, we'd do chanting. You know, right? And one of the chants we would do was the one that I ended our sit with. It's called "May There Be All Blessings." Bhavata sabha mangalam rakantu sabha devata. May there be every blessing, may all the devas protect you. Okay. So that was the evening blessing that we were doing before we went forth. And so we did that, and as that practice was coming to an end, I felt this, a kind of a golden aura. It was like a field that just kind of opened up around me. And there is the sense of being held and of being in refuge, you know, of really being protected. There is a sense of being uplifted. Okay. There was a sense of not being alone. Okay. And it was very powerful and it was very sweet. And it just sort of came unbidden, you know. And then as we were filing out of the retreat hall and walking down the hill, and I kind of went out of the hill. I started down out of the Dharma Hall and went down the hill. And then there was this very clear voice that said, "We are with you, okay? As you go forward, there may be danger." And I went and sat down on this bench on the hillside. It was about, you know, it was 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, looking out into the night sky with all the stars and feeling, you know, quite expansive and sort of at ease. And then suddenly, things changed radically, and I was overcome with essentially terror, you know, really powerful fear and shame and guilt. And there is this voice that said, "What do you think you're doing? You know, stop this right now. You're about to ruin your life. You know, you may lose the support and the love of your family, of your closest friends. What about your sangha? They may lose faith in you. They may want nothing more to do with you." And it was terror. It felt awful. And there's that saying, "Don't believe everything you think." These were really powerful feelings. And it was a lifetime of conditioning that had kept me in the closet. And it wanted to keep me there, you know. And so suddenly then I kind of recognized what it was. And this field just opened up completely, you know, and it became as big as the night sky. Turns out, for reasons I don't yet fully understand, 99.9%, 95% of the devas are beneficent. But actually, Mara is also one of the devas. So some of them are kinky. And so that's really what was going on. You know, I had this old consciousness was reasserting itself very powerfully. You know, and the mind was horribly contracted and just scary out of my wits, okay? Until suddenly, I saw that's what was going on and relaxed and everything opened up again. And then when that happened, that sense of calmness and peace and of being protected and of being held came back again. And each time since then, I've come out to friends, you know, one by one, and certainly with you all here tonight, it's that same thing. There is that presence. It's like one of the things that one of the teachers said on the retreat was, you know, a traditional saying, "The Dharma protects those who protect the Dharma." And so there's that kind of faith or confidence that's also come along with coming out. And, you know, call it what you will, whether it's training of the mind to inhabit a certain state of consciousness, empowerment created by Jung's collective unconsciousness, or superconsciousness, it continues to be made manifest, which is one of the reasons that this "May there be all blessings" chant has become one of my favorite ones. You know, it has real meaning, and I think it has real power. You know, the Nick Black Elk, the holy man of the Oglala Sioux, about whom the book, you know, Black Elk speaks and the Sacred Piper written, you know, made this observation once, you know, that our words have power because of the meaning we give them, you know. It sounds kind of self-evident on one hand, but this is really what he was talking about, you know, the intuitive, experiential aspect of how we use words, of how we convey meaning. So to return back to where I sort of began, you know, and what Greg Scharf was talking about that evening, you know, he said, it's really worth keeping an open mind about these things, you know. Not that it's true or not that it's not true or that you're fooling yourself or that it's an absolute reality, but simply keeping an open mind. And by keeping an open mind, what it also does is make available the possibility. You know, the Buddha with all of his teachings would say, abide contemplating the possibility that this is true. Okay. Not this is true, believe it or else. Abide contemplating the possibility that this is so. Once in 2003, I had been asked to be the Dharma teacher for a backpacking retreat. Being held in a really remote area in the Sierra Nevadas. And if whenever I was had been asked to do something that involved more responsibility as a Dharma teacher than before, I always check in with Joseph and say, well, do you, you know, you're ready to go do this? And he says, sure, just reflect on intention, and if it feels solid, then go ahead and do it. So I did. So we were out there, we're going into the backcountry on the first day, and I realized that not only had some of the people on this retreat never sat before and were about to undergo pretty powerful practice in a remote area, but some of them had real issues in terms of personality stuff and whatnot, and that this was going to be an interesting and at times probably kind of a rough ride. And suddenly I felt really kind of freaked, like I was sort of in over my head, you know. And so I walked off a little bit into the woods by myself and just sat there. And, you know, having used to be a Christian, what I would have done was say, God help me, what have I gotten myself into? But as it was, I was just saying, I just thought to myself, you know, kind of reaching out for whatever understanding or support there might be. And then suddenly there was this feeling, you know, the envisioning was, it was almost, it felt like I was essentially witnessing my teaching lineage, you know, going back a very long time, but there was the sense of presence, there was the sense of, it's okay, you know, trust the Dharma in you. The Dharma protects those who protect the Dharma. And yeah, there was, again, there was that sense of calmness and acceptance, and the retreat pretty much took care of itself. So whatever it is that's going on, it's a wonderful thing to have access to that, I don't know whether you want to call it a higher realm, but it's like we're tapping into something much greater than ourselves of beneficial intention. And the very idea that it's there for us is something that has really led me to keep an open mind about the Devas. So please, any thoughts, comments, reflections, questions? Now's a good time. So, Lisa, please.
Thank you for sharing. And I wanted to say, just share that, you know, when I was at your first talk after you came back from that retreat, there was like this lightness and this, to be fully honest, like a heart presence.
Yeah.
That I hadn't felt before. I was like, wow, something happened. Something,
yes,
it has. There's a change in me. And I really liked it.
Thank you.
So, make it a little bit more meaningful at this stage now. I feel, thank you. Keep that with you.
Thank you. Thank you. I feel honored. I feel honored by your words. And the GLBT discussion group, the leader said, you know, this just what you did. She said, I'm kind of in awe, you know, your courage, you know, doing this at 71 years of age, you know, instead of taking it to your grave. But I appreciate it. Yeah, please, Jim.
I'm just so proud of you. And I'm so, I think, not just me, but I think the Sangha here is just so honored to hear what you had to say tonight. It reminded me of a little piece from a Pax Christi book, which is the Catholic Peace Movement.
Uh-huh.
And it's Peacemaking Day by Day. And in it, there's this this rabbi who was a very old rabbinical scholar, right? Mm-hmm. And he had been studying the scriptures for years and giving wise teachings. And one day he met with one of his friends and he says, so, Rabbi, do you think you're going to be judged because you weren't a Moses or you weren't a this and you weren't a that? He said, no, I'll be judged because I wasn't Rabbi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as Lisa was pointing, you know, was mentioning, I feel more complete. You know, it's that no more secrets, nothing's being hidden. You know, it's the Dharma feels more complete. Yeah, please.
I couldn't quite see you because I'm almost in the back row, but I saw your shirt.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at it like, wow, you look great. I was going to go up to you afterwards.
I'm into Royal Robbins. Yeah, sorry. You're very kind. Appreciate it. You know, especially given the reaction that's happening right now, I feel safe here.
Yeah.
And so I'll probably be, you know, appearing. And, you know, I'm not going to sign up for RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm pretty, by and large, subtle about it. But I will probably be, especially here in Sangha, appearing more in feminine others. Yes, please.
Yeah, like other members of the Sangha have said, I genuinely commend you for opening up to the Sangha. I've been pretty open here about my struggles with anxiety and dealing with those really negative thoughts and like you're saying, those thoughts like, what is the Sangha gonna think about you? Well, I can only speak for myself, but I think a lot of other members have been pretty receptive to you speaking honestly about who you are.
Yes, thank you.
So I commend you for that first of all. So I do have a question that's a little more self-interesting. I've been pretty open here about my personal struggles and what I've had to deal with in terms of anxiety and have depression in the past. One of the things that kept me coming here is that I found so much wisdom in your Sangha talks. So the fact that you're opening up about yourself is more power to you.
Thank you.
In no way takes away from you. So my question is, do you have any advice for I guess a rookie, a starter, someone who's just starting off on the task and just always constantly looking for ways to make a bigger commitment to this path and deepen my own practice?
Thank you. One finds in Buddha Dharma actually much the same teaching that Jesus of Nazareth shared, which is, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. That there is something about being with the truth of your own being, whatever it happens to be, at any given point in time. of trusting your ability to know and accept the truth of who you are, of what's going on, is sort of like the fuel or the reaffirmation that makes it possible for the Dharma to continue to unfold. So, you know, you having shared your Dharma, the truth of your being, you know, that's getting grounded in the Dharma. That's learning how to trust the Dharma, learning how to trust this process. Thank you. I appreciate you sharing that. Please.
I just want to say I'm so happy for you. And then I just wanted to, I don't know if this is related or not, but I had an experience this week where something happened, you know, that it caught me, really surprised me. It was an incident with another person, and I didn't see it coming, and it just brought up this intense shame.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I couldn't even make sense of it. It was clearly like just like tapped into something so
yes.
old.
Yes.
And like, what, you know. And for, you know, it's kind of rocked my world for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm certainly much more settled now, but
mm-hmm.
I'd really like to, if you have any advice on like how to delve into it a little bit, you know, so that I can, because, you know, I mean, there's something to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, I don't know. And I you were talking about these devas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the qualities. And I'm just, it just struck me that perhaps, I don't know if it relates or not, but I'm...
Shame basically is a profound mistrust in yourself. It's a belief that there is something really wrong with you, something that's not right, you know, that you are a not right person in the world, that you are flawed and you are unworthy of kind regard from yourself or others. And it is a powerful and destructive and painful illusion. It's a story that we tell ourselves about ourselves. The Buddha Dharma practice is basically about seeing through shame, because shame is a construct of self. It's a construct of ego. And so when you recognize that it's a construct of ego, and you understand that the ego is an illusion, that it's something we create, that when you can see that that's the case, then the shame disaggregates. What takes its place is remorse, which is to say, maybe feeling bad about something that you did in the past that brought harm to somebody or to another. But since you're not seeing it from the present illusory state of self, but rather instead saying, oh, look what I did or what occurred when I was that person, you know. And understanding in these realms of consciousness, we're continuously giving rebirth to ourselves over and over and over and over again. So that you, your state of consciousness at that time was what resulted in you behaving like you did. But that if you can see it as just what it was, your state of mind at that time, rather than who you are now, then that creates this open field, this distance between the two. And the notion, and basically when you're talking about invoking the devas, you're talking about calling forth the qualities of mind, self-compassion being first among them, okay, to help hold yourself with kind regard as a way of dispelling shame. And we've gone and ripped through our time plus, you know, given that, you know, as Kathleen discussed, the shutting down is kind of an elaborate process, so we need to go our separate ways. Please, if you would, to come back to your sitting posture for just a moment. Bhavatu Sabha Mangalam Rakantu Sabha Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Buddha Nuba Vena Sarasoti Bhavantu Te. Through the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Dhamma Nubhavina Sadasoti Bhavantu Te. Through the power of all the Dhammas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavina Sada Soti Bhavantu Te. Through the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. Have a safe journey home.